Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do abuse and neglect threaten Texas children, and what role can public policy play in ensuring kids grow up safe and appropriate in their environments? After years of research, some child welfare advocates are convinced that home visits by qualified workers can teach struggling parents important skills for taking better care of their kids, resulting in not just short-term safety, but long-term physical and emotional health that can benefit families generations into the future. Madeline McClure is Executive Director of the Texas Association for the Protection of Children, also known as Tex Protects. It's an advocacy and education organization devoted to promoting evidence-based solutions to child abuse in all forms. Madeline, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me back.
So, how pervasive is child abuse in Texas?
Well, here's a good analogy. If you could imagine the Dallas Cowboys Stadium from an aerial view, filled to capacity at 80,000 people. Just imagine every one of those seats filled. Now, in your mind's eye, multiply that scenario three times over. And now envision every single one of those seats filled with a child 40% under the age of three. That's 200. That's still 1,100 seats short of the 241,000 kids that are reported for abuse every year in our state.
And how many of those reports turn out to be verifiable?
So about 117,000 of them are investigated. So not all are even investigated because it's very – so often people call in and they don't give information where CPS can actually track down the family and so forth. Or they screen them out. Mm-hmm. But of those, 64,000 were confirmed. So that's 176 kids are confirmed for abuse in Texas every day.
Is Texas worse than other states?
Actually, in terms of confirmed abuse per thousand, no, because of our large state. However, we rank number one in a total number of child abuse fatalities. We also rank, though we are ranking third from the top in child abuse fatalities per thousand. So it is a big problem and a bigger problem in Texas than it is most across the country.
And I think, Madeline, for many of us, our minds go instantly to cruel forms of punishment. But of course, neglect is the bulk of those cases.
That's right. Right. That's right. And, you know, I get that question quite often. It's only neglect. And yes, two-thirds of all the CPS cases are neglect. But, you know, if you asked most people, they would tell you that they were neglected as kids in a benign form. You know, mom didn't come to your soccer game or what have you. And that's not
being neglect. Left alone for hours on end when you're too young to handle it, that sort of thing.
That's right. And neglect would be really a child that's left in a car all day long in the heat. You know, so there's big consequences. Also, neglect that we're talking about is usually the neglect of an infant. And that's where you can really see the intense damage to neurodevelopment. So those precious years, 0 to 3, if an infant's left alone or in the care of a 5-year-old, let's say, for an entire day or weekend while mom and dad are out cavorting or what have you, that's neglect. And so it is a serious offense, and I wouldn't downplay its seriousness. But the big other abuse in Texas is physical abuse. We do have more physical abuse rate-wise than in other states, and then sexual abuse. We do not confirm emotional abuse very often. It's very hard to prove, but it can be extremely damaging to belittle or berate a child, treat siblings unequally, and really the true litmus test is whether that type of abuse has a significant impairment, mental, emotional, or physical impairment in the child.
Are there risk factors that abusive parents or other caregivers tend to have in common?
Yes. You'll find that the younger parents, teenage parents, single parents, impoverished parents, as well as those lacking in education, unwanted pregnancies, that's a biggie too. And so those factors combined. The other big risk is those that have been abused, neglected, or abandoned themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, unfortunately, children don't come with a set of instructions, even though your cell phone does and your radio and your computer. The most difficult job any parent ever has is raising a child. And we take it so for granted. In fact, some ways I think that I'm amazed that abuse doesn't happen more often. So when you really think through what happens when children have been raised in an abusive environment or neglected, that's how they know to raise their own children without an intervention. And not only is it learned behavior, but we know now from the scientific research that children actually have a DNA change once they are brought up in a certain way. So it's not just learned behavior, it's biology. And that has a significant impact in chromosome structure.
So people are always thinking about not simply ways to intervene after abuse has happened, but what we can do to prevent this. And one of the things that a lot of people have begun to really advocate is the idea of preventive care before there's any abuse taking place in the form of these home visits. Can you explain those to me?
Yes. Home visitation is really parent family training in the environment of the home of the parent. So what these programs do is they pair up professionals or specially trained paraprofessionals with high-risk parents, those that I just mentioned. So it usually could be low income or those that have lacking in education or very often folks don't understand child development. You know, some folks will say, oh, I didn't know a child could actually hear at 6 months. Hmm. So anyway, so the high-risk families are paired with this individual professional that visits the family, hopefully as early as during pregnancy to help mom with maternal behaviors, which reduce a whole host of problems later on, but mainly really teaching mom, coaching her and the rest of the family on basic parenting, well baby, well care behaviors, and appropriate discipline. The visits can go, you know, starting at birth. Some home visiting programs start actually during toddlerhood, but there's a continuum of programs that start as early as very early in the pregnancy up to 3 to 5 years old. And they all have in common the very primary role parents have in raising a child. So these programs not only are found to be one of the very few inoculations we have against child abuse and neglect, but they also mitigate things like preterm births, low birth weight babies. They actually enhance child's cognitive development. And we found that these programs enhance school readiness. So many of these parents were never read to themselves and don't even understand that that's important, that children even have a capacity to soak up language in the early environment. So one of the things we teach moms in these visits is that during the children's 0 to 3 years, they are creating 700 synapses. That's the neural connections per second. Hmm. 700 per second. That's over 12 million a day. But they're use dependent. So if mom is not interacting or talking to that child or other family members aren't interacting, it's a use it or lose it. Alternatively, if those synapses, if the child is undergoing an environment of trauma and stress, those neural connections can be damaged and result in a lifelong pattern of a hypersensitivity, a hyperarousal, very similar to some post-traumatic stress features. So those early years are so critical, and this is a time where these home visitors teach these parents about that critical nature. Plus, they really do connect these families with resources that they might need in terms of substance abuse or mental health services or just basic housing, food, basic things like that. And then finally, the goal of a lot of these programs is to help the families create self-reliance, maybe go back to school and get a job. And then, you know, really, they have a wonderful return on investment as well.
So these are voluntary programs for the families. How are target populations identified and sort of made aware of the existence of these programs?
Right. Well, you know, it's sort of arbitrary when you think of targeted populations as just being poor. But unfortunately, we find that parents that are living at or below the federal poverty level, which is about $23,000 for a family of four, tend to have a lot of risk factors. So in trying to find out where you want to target these services, that's one way. But just because people are poor doesn't mean they have a host of risk factors. Mm-hmm. Now, the other way to identify them is through a needs assessment that the state did to apply for some federal dollars, and that needs assessment looked at factors such as low birth weights, immunizations, high infant mortality, substance abuse, underemployment, unemployment, violence in the community. And so we've mapped out areas of Texas that really could benefit from these programs. But you don't want to just plop an intervention into a community. You want the community has to want it. And certainly, you mentioned the voluntary nature. That is critical. There's certainly no government overreach or mandating. The programs don't work if you mandate folks to participate anyway. But where we do identify these families are within the WIC clinic or in the prenatal care clinic, as well as DISD. They send us children that are pregnant in the school system. Children in the foster care system very often become pregnant, so they're identified in that way. From several sources. And so those parents that are interested in getting services can call a central line, and there's an information and referral network that assigns them to the program that best suits their needs.
Madeline McClure is with us. She's Executive Director of the Texas Association for the Protection of Children. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment, and you can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. In the meantime, we want to take a short break right now to ask you to please make your gift of support to KERA by going online to kera.org or calling 1-888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is here with us now in the studio. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And this is such an important topic, and I'm really glad that we're able to take the time today to address it, to discuss it, to bring it to the Think Show. However, you know, doing this show does have a cost, and bringing you these kinds of interviews, these kinds of important conversations come with a cost. And we've got to keep the lights on. We have to run the transmitter. We have to have people here to make the station work. That's why we're in fundraising right now. This is our spring membership campaign. And Chris, we're working on kind of an interesting sort of match challenge today. There's a very generous donor of KERA who's offered $10,000 in sort of a bonus pool. If you make a contribution right now, 25% of your contribution will be bonused from that pool. We started with $10,000 this morning, and we have about $4,649 left in that pool right now. So if you make a $120 contribution, which is about what most people do, an extra $30 will be given to KERA in your honor.
That's fantastic. And we definitely don't want to have that money sitting here at the end of the day, not put in use to serve you with more programming. So make your contribution now at kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. For the entire drive, we have $267,000 left to raise. And we know we need to raise that money because that's what we need to serve you until the next fundraising drive comes along. That's why we have the specific amount.
Yeah, we're well over halfway. We started a little over a week ago with a goal of $650,000, just $267,000 left to raise. And Chris, if it tells you anything, when Sylvia Komatsu and I were on this morning during Morning Edition, we started the day pretty close to that $300,000 left to raise mark.
Yeah.
So it's been a great day. Thanks to everyone who's responded, but we're still waiting to hear from you. Call now 888-694-6931 or click and contribute at kera.org.
Once again, every dollar you match will be you give will be matched by a 25-cent bonus gift to KERA from an anonymous donor. So make that contribution now at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about preventing child abuse and neglect in Texas with Madeline McClure, who is Executive Director of the Texas Association for the Protection of Children, also known online as Tex Protects. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So doing research, I saw that these are evidence-based programs, these home programs. Can you talk a little bit about how they're tested and how the populations that the families that go through these programs compare with people who have the same risk factors but don't have the advantage of going through such a program?
Right. So to get to the level of evidence-based, that really requires that parents or any participant is assigned to what's called the intervention group.
Mm-hmm.
And then a equally matched group. So in other words, folks that look like the same demographic in the same neighborhood, same income, maybe education or so, are assigned to the control group. And those two groups are followed over a period of time. It has to be of a substantive sample size to make sure that it's not some threat to the validity of the program mm-hmm. that's causing the outcomes. But essentially what we do is we're trying to determine the differences between those two groups and evaluating the efficacy of the intervention and making sure that it's not some other thing that's going on, such as time or other, you know, things that might be happening in the community. And that's why it's so critical to have a randomized control trial so that folks that are wanting the service are virtually – they're assigned randomly to the control group or the intervention group. Mm-hmm. The desire of somebody to want to be in a program can determine a lot about the outcome. So that's what makes it really an experimental trial where you can have – go to the bank with the outcomes.
So there are not quite 20,000 families in Texas right now in programs such as the ones we've been discussing. How many would like to be enrolled or could benefit from enrollment?
Yes, and so that's a good point. So the families that qualify for services are about 480,000 families in Texas with children under the age of six that are living at federal poverty level. Now, only about half of those will accept services. So our ultimate goal for 2023, our 10-year goal, is to reach that 225,000. That's the number that we project will be at the federal poverty level. And accept services. However, if we really want to get to the highest of need, we're going to target those that are making only 50% of the federal poverty level. And that, believe it or not, that's $11,525 for a family of four with children under the age of six. And so I'll be happy if we reach 115,000 families by 2023.
Is there a multiplier effect? In other words, if one neighbor goes through a program like this and is raising her children, and I should say there are men who are involved as well. Often it's single moms, but there are fathers as well. Does that person then influence the folks across the street who haven't had the benefit of belonging?
That's a great question, and that's something we haven't captured in the research yet. But we know anecdotally that, especially with our families that we're serving that live in what I call beehive living in apartment buildings, they're talking to one another. They socialize with one another. They see a nurse or an early child development specialist coming to their neighbor's house. They're curious about it. While they're taking a break on the front step, they will share stories. And not only that, I've been on these home visits and so often I find that it's the mother of the mother that's living at home with a child as well. So these are, 14, 15, 16, 18-year-old girls, for better or worse. But their moms often have children themselves. So their 38-year-old grandma has a little infant, and she has – it's very interesting, the dynamic, to have that home visitor teaching the new mother versus the mom who's got different ideas. And I've overheard things like, well, no, you know, from the older mother, oh, a child should be potty trained by age one. And the nurse or the home visitor saying, well, that's a little young. So, but they do defer to the professional, which is fantastic. Dads get involved too. It is interesting. Once they are involved early in that visit, they stay involved. I was invited to speak to a group of mothers that graduated from one of the programs, and I was walking across the park in Dallas Park to speak to this group, and they were in a gazebo outside, and I could see that there was all these mothers, about 50 mothers and babies, and as I got closer, I saw there were also 50 fathers, and they were bouncing the babies on their lap. It wasn't like they were standing having a drink by the barbecue and just looking, waiting to get through it. They were engaged. And so that was so encouraging to see fathers involved and knowing that these early years, this isn't just a little blob that doesn't have any receptors. They know that this child is, you know, just a sponge and taking in so much. So I think that that part of the program, that that needs to be researched. You know, what are the benefits to fathers on their psychological health as well as their employment and their arrest rates? We've only studied the subsequent juvenile delinquency rates of the offspring and the mothers. So there's a lot more research to be done in looking at the impact of home visiting programs on fatherhood.
So if you want to serve more people than are currently being served now, or if the people who provide these services want to do that, it would seem to make sense, as we love to make everything like a business in this country, to say, well, let's just put 40 moms at a time in a big classroom and teach the same skills. Why is it so important to do this one-on-one and within the specific home setting?
Right. And so that's a perfect question. Makes a lot of sense. You can do classroom settings and parenting education outside of the home, and it has some benefits for certain populations. Unfortunately, our highest need families, number one, have such transportation issues. Mm-hmm. You would be so shocked. I've been in rooms with home visitors, and transportation, that's the big issue, especially in areas like Arlington. There's no public transportation. You know, cars are expensive. Gas is super expensive. I mean, this is not an option. Now, that's one. But again, even if folks do have transportation, what you gain when you're in somebody's home in assessing these dangers, like a loose wires in the cabling, families don't even see sometimes their own traps for injuries to children. Mm-hmm. Stoves where kids have access to a flame and things like that, or really just seeing that there's nothing in the refrigerator. Some people think that's normal. The most important thing, I think, is while mom is talking to her therapist and the mother is completely ignoring her crying child. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you want to ignore a crying child if nothing else works. But this is just a matter of basic response the mother has, because that's how she was raised. So right. That nurse or early child development specialist or social worker can intervene and say, hey, let's see about Junior if he needs bathing or changing or feeding. And really, the person in the environment tells a lot of the story. And you can see how she might jump if the dad comes home, and, you know, whether there's domestic violence. And therapy in the kitchen is a lot more powerful than being in a classroom situation. So we find the benefits are much greater for certain populations.
So let's talk about the Texas legislature having taken up these issues in this session. What are they considering? And if they want to move forward with expanding these programs, where does the money come from?
So we have a $27 million request for new funding this session, and that's in addition to the $17.8 million we have in the base budget for the Nurse Family Partnership. Unfortunately, I'm not getting all $27 million this session, but we are getting so far – we've got about $7.9 million for expansion in the Senate budget. So this is going to conference committee. In other words, when there's a difference between the House version of the budget mm-hmm. and the Senate version, the lieutenant governor appoints 5 members of the Senate and the speaker appoints 5 members of the House to work out the differences. And right now we don't have that $7.9 million in the House. So we really need our House legislators to get on board and accept the Senate or concur with the Senate's version.
And did I read this right? There are for every dollar that the state spends or that any organization spends on programs like these, there's, is it like 470 or 570 that is returned in saved costs from incidents of child abuse?
Well, yes, it's a $5.70 return on investment from several sources, Chris. So number one would be, yes, a 48% reduction in child abuse in that particular study. Also a 79% decrease in prenatal births. So NICU births are extraordinarily expensive. And you've got 10,000 births at Parkland a year. A lot of those wind up in NICU if you don't have prenatal, good behaviors early on and so forth, as well as hypertension during birth. The savings also come from increasing moms' labor force participation. That's a biggie, as well as reducing her dependence on welfare by about 20%. The other cost savings is a reduction in crime rates. Not only does the mother have a 59% decrease in arrest rates, but her offspring at age 15, we find that it's a 60% decrease in the juveniles, juvenile delinquency rate. So this is what makes this so magic. It's a two-generation program. These programs. They're not only affecting these young parents, but the offspring. And this is how we break the cycle of violence. But just to get back to your question on funding for the next session, not only do we have the $7.9 million request in, but we have some legislation that will allow any Texas citizen that's applying for a marriage license or getting a copy of a marriage license, birth certificate, or divorce decree to now make a $5 contribution on the form when they're purchasing those items. So this was my little brainchild, and at least we're keeping it optional, which makes certain legislators very happy.
It's got to be hard to say no to, which is great. It's perfect. You make it optional, but people can say yes or no.
Exactly. Well, I thought that it might make sense to have a mandatory birth certificate fee, but we've got a pretty conservative legislature that is saying no, no, no to any new fees, et cetera. So I decided to settle for the optional donation. But the sum estimates from the Legislative Budget Board thinks we're going to raise something like $1.5 million per year, $3 to $4 million for the biennium from that mechanism alone. So I'm very thrilled that we'll be able to possibly get as high as about $10 million this session for additional home visiting programs.
Madeline McClure is with us. She's Executive Director of the Texas Association for the Protection of Children. We'll speak more with her and take up this conversation again in a few minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We also want to remind you of another important phone number today. That is 1-888-694-6931. That's the telephone number you call to join KERA as a member for the first time, perhaps to support the station again for like the 30th time in a row or something in between. Your contribution today will be matched with an additional 25% from an anonymous donor to the station, up to a total for the day of $10,000. We still have about $4,600 left in the pot, so you can make a contribution right now and have an extra donation go to the station just by taking action, which is pretty great. Jeff Whittington is here now. He is executive producer of Think. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. What a great conversation. Again, it's really important. Thanks to everybody who's tuning in and listening today. Thanks to everyone who's contributing as well. The phone number to call, 888-694-6931. Or you can make your contribution online safely and securely at kera.org. We do have a variety of thank you gifts available when you join the station. You can check those out online at kera.org. Or when you make the phone call, if there's a book or an author you heard on the Diane Rehm Show or on Think, or possibly on Fresh Air over the last week, chances are that that thank you gift is still available when you join the station with a $10 a month contribution. We've got all kinds of things like the Eton wind-up radio that's a great possibility for you. But you know what? Most people just give and choose not to take a thank you gift. They want all of their contribution to go straight to programming. It's totally up to you. But once you make the decision to support the station, please call 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org.
It just takes a couple of minutes of your time. Most people who join the station join again and again and again, if that lets you know how satisfied they are with their contribution. We're really proud to be able to serve you. When additional money comes in, the first thing we think about is how we can provide you with additional programming. And you hear your money at work all throughout the year. Every time you turn on the radio, there is great programming from NPR, from the BBC, from KERA, and it's greatly expanded news, local and regional news presence. We're bringing you a lot more state news. All of that is in request to your response. We sort of did that in good faith, expecting and knowing that you would come back and make a contribution so that we can pay for all this good coverage.
That's why we're asking you to help support it right now at 888-694-6931 or at kera.org. Chris, we started a little over a week ago with a goal of $650,000. The light at the end of the tunnel gets brighter and brighter as we get closer and closer to finishing. About $266,000 left to raise right now. It's a lot of money. Don't get me wrong. That is a lot of money. However, we know that once we get past the halfway point, which we're well past the halfway point at this point, many of you decide, you start to say, oh, all right, I'll get on board. And you start, putting those thoughts into action and making that phone call. When you make your phone call to 888-694-6931, you help us whittle down this overall goal. You inspire others to support the station. And then you also help provide this radio news and information service to everybody in the North Texas area. Even people, and yes, there are people who cannot afford to support the station, and this station is here for them too, and you're helping make it possible for them to get the news and information that they need to make informed choices as a citizen of our region.
And most of us are really happy to give a little extra, knowing that there's someone out there who literally could not afford to make a contribution. But there's lots of us that don't love the idea of making contributions for people who listen all the time, who could make a donation but don't. Think about that. Think about your engagement with the station, how much KERA tells you about the world, how much your reading list comes from listening to this show, how many things you've learned from Jeff's show on Fridays. And then think about what that is worth to you. A sustaining membership is so easy and so affordable. You can easily give $120, even $240, $360 a year, often without really feeling it, because we take this month by month from your debit or credit account.
Your contribution right now at 888-694-6931 makes it all possible, from every show you hear on the station to this conversation about preventing child abuse. Perhaps even your contribution during the show today might help a child. Think about that. Think about the impact of your contribution to KERA, a station and a news and information service that covers the entire waterfront of very important issues, and then call 888-694-6931 or contribute at kera.org.
Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about preventing child abuse and neglect in Texas with Madeline McClure, who is Executive Director of the Texas Association for the Protection of Children. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So if we put state money into this, how do we keep programs that are providing these services accountable for the money they receive?
Well, we certainly want to make sure that our money is going towards programs that have evidence versus those that have no evidence. So what we have is a bill, Senate Bill 426, Senator Nelson's bill, that will ensure we have evaluation of these programs ongoing to ensure that they are implemented with fidelity, mm-hmm. or with the exact same dosing like the original research model. We see maybe that these programs have been successful in other states and other regions with different populations, but we have to evaluate and make sure that they're successful here.
Right.
And so this bill is our Texas Home Visiting Accountability Act. And it provides a framework to make sure that at least 75% of the funds are going towards the evidence-based, but we allow up to 25% to go to promising practices because so many of these up-and-coming programs are innovative. They're going to try to reach families that we heretofore haven't been able to reach mm-hmm. as well, the ones that turn down services or find new ways of getting the father more involved or actually addressing sexual abuse, which not all the home visiting programs do. So this is a quality improvement, quality assurance, monitoring for fidelity to the research model and ensuring that home visiting programs set clear standards and they're accountable for those outcomes.
And what's the Child Protection Act?
The Child Protection Act is our bill that builds on something we passed last legislative session. Our own local Senator West and Tan Parker from Tarrant County have helped us last session ensure that new teachers and all child care staff are trained in recognizing, reporting, and preventing child abuse. However, last session, we had a lot of pushback from the school systems. We wanted to have all school professionals be trained in this, but I think because of the budget cuts last session, they were looking at any new mandate, even if it was a well-meaning mandate, as unfunded and unfair. But this go-around, we've got the school professionals, all of the boards, they're on board with it. They are going to make sure that every single school teacher is trained in this, as well as coaches or janitors or any professional, librarians, counselors, anybody that has contact with children. And now we're also expanding it to university professionals. So our institutions of higher education are on alert that if they have exposure to children on their campuses, whether it's coaches or daycare centers or so you name it, that they are also trained in how to recognize, report, and prevent child abuse. So much sexual abuse. When I've been in certain situations where I've heard perpetrators tell interviewers what allowed them to sexually abuse a child. And there's several things that come around. Mostly, of course, they have a perversion or proclivity to being attracted to young children. But also, it's opportunity. And when children are neglected and abandoned, or they are without parents that are guiding them, or they're alone in school, that's where opportunities come up and perpetrators know how to prey on them. So these kinds of programs, these kinds of trainings really do help us with our first line of defense. We know that, of course, children are first and foremost abused by their families. But it's child care workers and school professionals that can identify those risk factors and that can identify the signs of abuse and that can prevent the child from being continually abused and sometimes prevent them from being sexually abused by somebody in the environment, on school campuses or in a child care setting.
I want to talk about the things that keep people from reporting when they have that strange feeling that something is not right. And I understand that when you make a report, when you call, say, Child Protective Services, it's not like a criminal allegation. If it turns out to be unfounded, no one's got an unfair criminal record, that sort of thing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great question. I find that most people are terrified of calling CPS because they think through one call it's going to result in a child's removal from their parents.
Like, what if I'm wrong and I've ruined a family or whatever?
Right. Mm-hmm. And what you should know is out of those 241,000 allegations, we've only removed 16,700 kids. We have the lowest rate of removals in the state, in the country.
Is that good or bad?
Well, it's good insofar as for those families that get family preservation services where we say, well, yes, abuse looks like it almost occurred or it has occurred, but we really could reduce risk factors by providing mom with some mental health services so she doesn't sleep all day and she does manage to take care of her children, or getting dad some anger management if the abuse isn't it's so high risk that it's containable and there's a willingness to work with the department and in meeting a safety plan or service plan. But I mean, I think that very often we do err on the side of leaving children in our homes, and that's why we have such a high child abuse fatality rate. One of the reasons we have a child abuse fatality rate. But back to your question, what you do need to know is where the child lives and their name. That's very important for CPS to follow up when you're making a call. But you certainly don't need to know. Nobody's asking you to have a verifiable absolute. You are held without – you're immune from any kind of prosecution if you make a report in good faith. Mm-hmm. Now, if you make a false report, right, which does happen with bickering custody-fueled parents, which is amazing, but it does happen, then it rises to not only just a Class A misdemeanor, but it rises to a state jail felony if you make a false report. And to that point, we decided that this legislative session, it makes no sense that somebody making a false report while a big offense that doesn't hurt a child is a state jail felony, while somebody that doesn't make a report and conceals abuse and they're a professional and they're hiding it intentionally from authorities and allowing a child to continually be abused, right, that is should be at least a range of a Class C misdemeanor to up to a state jail felony. So that's one of our other pieces of legislation this session. Senator Corona is carrying that for us and Tan Parker. It is, and we're not trying to punish people that just didn't know they should report, but these are mandated professionals like teachers, doctors, nurses, other school personnel, and law enforcement. So we want to make sure we set out that very clearly that protecting or putting the best interest of an institution's over the best interest of a child is just going to be unacceptable in this state.
What can we do to reduce the stress on people who do this work for a living? I know that the turnover rate, even though it's better than it was, it's still exceptionally high.
It's still exceptionally high. And over the many years I've been doing this, Chris, it has barely come down, really. We have about 38% turnover for our new workers. That compares to overall state employees turnover about 15, 16, 17%. So
over the course of a year, is that it?
That's a course of a year, annual turnover rate. So over a third of your staff is leaving every year after you train them for 3 months in a training academy, after you post for the job, after you give them half a caseload their first 6 months on the job. It's a huge cost center. What can we do? We have got to work more and more on the caseloads. Now, while the caseloads have come down since we started CPS reform in 2005, the cases themselves are getting more intense. There's much more domestic violence involved. There's much more drug abuse. There's so many people involved in the family and the family dynamics. It's very intensive for a worker to go in. It's not just your nuclear family. There's many members and lots of people living in the home. The other thing that we can do is try to get these caseworkers' salaries somewhere on par with other first responders. They're paid far less than fire department professionals or law enforcement. And I don't want to pick on teachers because everybody knows that teachers are underpaid, you know. But still, even caseworkers are earning something like 50 cents on the dollar of what teachers get if you look on a paid day basis. Mm-hmm. But it is very uneven because all caseworkers get paid the same around the state, no matter what the cost of living differential. And I'd like to see that salary more tailored to that cost of living so that there's not such a huge break. And the bottom line is we lose so many caseworkers to the teaching profession, which is why I use it as a comparison. It's certainly not to say teachers get paid enough, but certainly our caseworkers. Who is going to, with a master's degree in social work, apply to CPS to work starting at $31,000 a year with 25 to 40 kids on your case while you're ignoring your own families? You're so stressed out. And one of the first things I see with caseworkers is as soon as they start the job, they wind up gaining 10 or 15 or 20 pounds because they don't think they even can allow themselves to exercise or eat well or stop their work because there's all these kids at risk on their case.
Madeline McClure is Executive Director of the Texas Association for the Protection of Children. You can find more information about the organization online at textprotects.org. Madeline, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. Thanks to those of you paying attention and calling in and sending emails. We especially want to thank those of you who have made contributions of financial support over the last 54 minutes of the show. You can join this esteemed group by going online to kera.org or making your contribution over the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Hi, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. The phone number, again, 888-694-6931. Of course, online, you can make your contribution always safely and securely online at kera.org. Chris, we started this morning with $10,000 in this bonus pool. And the way it works is when you make a contribution, your contribution, 25% of it, will be bonused to the station thanks to the generosity of a very generous listener.
I like thinking about the bonus pool. Like you throw in $100 and 25 extra dollars splashes back up onto the deck that is the KERA coffers. Think of it that way.
Yeah, okay. Well,
that is nice.
That's nice. Or let's see, what else is another? Oh, so like if you buy... I don't know, something healthy. I'm trying to think of something healthy. Like, well, never mind. I've been here for a few hours today.
Jeff was here before 6 this
maybe
morning.
You know what I should do? I should probably just read what's just been handed to me, which is a list of people to thank who've made
a
contribution.
Great people, yeah.
Thanks so much to Douglas Derricott in Plano, Scott Schallenberger in Frisco, Leon Getz in Dallas. Also, thanks to Patricia and Fred Cullum in Dallas and Linda Noblin in Dallas. They've made their contribution here in just the last few minutes by calling 888-694-6931 or contributing online at kera.org. The math I was trying to work out a minute ago, think of it this way. If you make a $120 contribution, this very generous listener of KERA is going to make sure that an additional $30 goes to the station out of the $10,000 bonus pool on your behalf, in your honor. So really, it's a chance for you today to make your contribution stretch that much further. A friend's contribution of $1,500 will unlock $375 from the bonus pool for KERA. So it is really a great opportunity today when we just have about $266,000 left to raise in the entire drive to help sort of get the snowball rolling here.
You listen to public radio. You rely on KERA. You always know that when you need information, you can turn on the radio or go to kera.org and you'll find it there. We sort of rely on you in the same way, although we only are able to act on this a few times a year. But we expect that when we need money to send reporters to do coverage in the state capitol, or we need to send reporters across town, or we want to put on a local focused discussion on the show, we love to be able to come to you and ask for your support. So many of you understand this completely, and we want to thank you for having supported us for years and years. There are some of you out there, though, who are sort of rooting for us from the sidelines, thinking, okay, well, I hope KERA gets this, and you're sort of cheering for us that things work out. We want you here on the field. We want you to join in, be part of the team that makes public radio possible, and it's just so easy to do it. You score a home run,
wow,
and you improve your batting
coach
average
talk
by 25%. From me, of all people.
That's coach talk, Chris Boyd.
What's in this teacup? you can do this right now at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. I have a youthful soccer player, so I've learned some scoring terms.
Yes, and the
some sporting,
you know,
terms,
team and sporting philosophy.
Yes,
yeah, move the ball down the field, score more points than the other team.
Right,
but in this case, Chris, you're right. We're all on the same team. You know, we're not. There's not anybody. Well, they're probably. You know what? I take that back. There may be someone who's like, I hope they don't make the goal.
You know, you wonder why they're still listening.
Well, that's the thing. They are listening. You are listening. And I've said many times, there are those of you who will one day give to the station. Maybe it's not today, maybe it's not next year, maybe it's not 5 years from now, but someday you will. And I always say my goal is to make today that day, to get you to decide that, well, you know what, eventually I'll give to the station, so I might as well just do it today. And then I think there are people who listen, and maybe you're one of them, dear listener, who plans to never give and never will give.
But it's not, we're not selling you timeshare here.
No,
right?
You're already using the product.
You're using the product. Yeah. You know it's a good value. It'd be like, you know, you belong to a gym. If you go to the gym, you go, the first time you go, maybe you get a guest pass for a day or a week. If you could go to that gym, but every day you sort of went to the little free basket and filled out your name and dropped it in and never paid, you'd feel weird about that after a while. Loving this gym, hanging out there all the time.
You can do that?
You're not supposed to is the point.
Wow.
But then you realize the gym is adding, they're adding a Stairmaster and they're adding, you know, weight machines and they're rubberizing their track. I don't know. I think
sports
I need to get.
Sports and gyms and stuff?
It's springtime. I need to get back into conditioning.
Okay, okay.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't go in
right.
free every day, even if you could, because
right.
you just know it's not right.
So do the right thing. Call 888-694-6931. Help pay for that Stairmaster that you're using, that Stairmaster of the mind when you tune in to Chris Boyd's show, Think. Go online to KERA.org or call 888-694-6931.
$4,400 left in our bonus pool of 25% additional contributions when you make your gift right now. Get part of that added to your contribution by going online to KERA.org or calling 1-888-694-6931.
Think is sponsored in part by the Horchow family, celebrating the vast array of ideas heard each day on KERA.